From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Jennifer Mitchell with the news on this day in Maine, February 14th, 2020. U.S. Senator Susan Collins has sent a letter to the federal government asking it to pull back on changes that have put more than $1 million in grants for rural Maine schools in jeopardy. Robbie Feinberg has more.
Late last month, Maine's Department of Education alerted districts that they could lose $1.2 million in federal grants from the Rural Education Achievement Program, which helps pay for expenses such as technology, mental health counselors, and art and phys ed teachers in rural schools. The potential cuts come as a result of changes at the Federal Department of Education, which says that it had been, quote, erroneously allowing the state to use free lunch rates rather than census estimates to measure eligibility for one grant program. But the state warns those changes could make more than 100 districts ineligible for certain grants. In a letter sent on Thursday, Collins called on the department to, quote, immediately reverse this misguided change so that students in schools are, quote, spared from drastic cuts that will affect the quality of public education in rural America. Collins co-authored the Rural Education Achievement Program in 2002. The Maine Department of Education says it has reached out to every district in the state affected by the changes. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And legislators yesterday took almost 3 hours of testimony on a bill that would restrict the availability of four neonicotinoid pesticides. The bill faces criticism from landscapers and some farmers. Harry Ricker is an apple grower in Turner.
This bill is what we call a slippery slope towards affecting us farmers and some of the better chemicals that we can use to help protect our produce, apples in our case.
Ricker says the chemicals are safe when used properly, but bill sponsor Nicole Grahosky of Ellsworth says it's not reasonable to expect the average homeowner to know all the risks.
These people don't have endless free time to research which chemicals are more or less toxic, nor are many likely to read the very fine print on the back of a bottle.
Supporters say restricting the chemicals named in the bill will help struggling pollinators such as bees. Both critics and supporters say changes to language and clarifications are needed.
This week on Maine's Political Pulse, sizing up the Democratic candidates vying to unseat President Donald Trump as Maine prepares for its presidential primary. Also, more fallout for Republican Senator Susan Collins after voting to acquit the president. Join me, Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler, and Senior Correspondent Mal Leary for Maine's Political Pulse. Available online by Friday afternoons, also on the air Sunday during weekend edition, and during Monday's morning edition. Maine's Political Pulse, available anytime at mainepublic.org.
This Day in Maine is made possible by the Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland. DempseyCenter.org.
On the next Maine Calling, Maine's role in the slave trade, an encore presentation. I'm Keith Shortall. History may give New England a reputation for being a force against slavery, but recent research has uncovered the significant role that Maine's shipping industry played in the slave trade throughout the 1800s, even after it was made illegal. Listen back to our discussion about this troubling period in Maine's history. Maine Calling, Monday at 1 and again at 8 on Maine Public Radio.
Two Maine hospitals are listed on a federal government website that tracks the most serious quality deficiencies cited in the past 6 months. As the Bangor Daily News first reported this week, Maine Medical Center and York Hospital were both identified for patient safety issues. Patty White reports.
According to reports from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, there were two incidents of patient abuse at Maine Medical Center last summer. In July, a security officer was allegedly struck by a patient with a mental illness being placed in a restraint. The officer responded by striking the patient several times and continued to work for 6 hours before being placed on leave. In another incident in August, an 83-year-old patient with dementia spat out medication and punched the nurse administering it. The nurse called the patient an expletive and punched their rib area. Maine Medical Center spokesperson Clay Holtzman says in a written statement that the two staff members are no longer employed at the hospital and that Maine Med has enhanced its training on de-escalation techniques. Holtzman also notes that healthcare institutions across the U.S. are facing, quote, an epidemic of violence against healthcare staff. and that public awareness is critical to ensure these institutions are places of healing. York Hospital was also cited for two incidents involving patient safety. One involved a vascular surgeon who performed an operation but was unlicensed in Maine. Hospital spokeswoman Jody Merrill says the surgeon practiced in New Hampshire and was called in for an emergency.
They are licensed in a state which is a mere few minutes away from Maine. So they were able to come in for the emergent case, and they were able to perform a life-saving procedure. The patient had an excellent outcome, and it was really in thanks to this provider doing what was ethically, ethically best for the patient.
The other incident at York Hospital involved the father of a patient who took part in his daughter's C-section. The father, who was a physician but not licensed in Maine, reportedly held retractors at the incision site and suctioned the baby's nose. Merrill says that situation was at the request of the patient.
The staff was able to oversee and ensure that the care felt appropriate and in compliance with the patient's wishes.
Merrill says that York Hospital has taken definitive steps to ensure that these situations, although they produced positive patient outcomes, don't occur again. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services now lists both hospitals' deficiencies as corrected. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Tribal leaders, lawmakers, religious groups, and others are urging passage of nearly two dozen recommended changes to the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Implementing Act by a state task force. During a lengthy public hearing before the legislature's Judiciary Committee today, supporters said that Maine's federally recognized tribes have been crippled by legal restrictions in the 1980 Settlement Act that made reparations for land taken from them. But as Susan Sharon reports, concerns are being raised by sportsmen and by Maine's Attorney General and Governor.
Maine tribes should enjoy the same rights, privileges, powers, and immunities as other federally recognized Indian tribes in the United States. That was the language used to establish a state task force to examine the 1980 Land Claims Settlement Act last June. Tribal leaders say it underscores the fundamental problem they face, a lack of parity with their native counterparts in other states, and as sovereign nations.
The settlement in 1980 reduced us to mere municipalities.
Daryl Newell, vice chief of the Passamaquoddy tribe at Indian Township, says he can remember when tribal members were wards of the state, lived in tar paper shacks, and had no indoor plumbing or electricity. Federal recognition in the 1970s led to new housing, schools, and health facilities. Self-determination was being restored, Newell says, until the land claims settlement stifled relationships and economic growth. But Newell says working on the task force has restored his hopes.
I believe that we can work together and again nurture a government-to-government relationship that has been near void for some time now.
The task force has recommended giving the tribes exclusive jurisdiction over fishing and hunting, as well as the right to regulate natural resources on federally recognized tribal lands. Tribes would also be able to tax non-members on tribal lands, operate casinos with slot machines and table games, and have jurisdiction over certain crimes, including in cases of domestic violence committed by non-Indians on tribal lands. Penobscot Nation Chief Kirk Francis says one of the biggest limitations of the act is a provision that was added in Congress at the 11th hour without the tribe's knowledge.
That said, the tribes of Maine would not benefit from congressional acts specifically for the benefit of Indians unless we were specifically mentioned in those bills.
In other words, every time legislation is passed that affects tribes in the United States, the Maine tribes are excluded unless they are specifically mentioned by name. And Francis says jurisdictional conflicts between the tribes and the state have resulted in costly litigation and stifled economic development.
We're going to do a tribal permit and a state permit. There's tribal fees, there's state taxes, and so it just turns off investment.
But David Trahan of the Sportsmen's Alliance of Maine said he and his members object to some of the changes proposed in the bill, including the potential elimination of state management of fisheries and wildlife resources.
The Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, are they doing something wrong? Are they mismanaging the resource? We don't understand exactly what this is trying to achieve.
Trahan says he worries about turning over the task of wildlife management to the tribes and federal government. He says it will result in a confusing management scheme, one for state lands and one for tribal. And Attorney General Aaron Fry urged the committee to use caution in implementing the task force recommendations.
The legislature's authority to amend the Maine Implementing Act, it's limited, because any amendments to the MIA require both the tribes and the state to agree to that amendment.
In addition, Fry says, Congress may also be required to endorse some of the changes. In a letter to members of the committee, Governor Janet Mills said she is also concerned about, quote, the sweeping nature of the bill, the impacts on non-tribal citizens and communities, and the extent to which those impacts have been given due consideration and explained to the public. Instead, the governor said she worries that the bill could give rise to disputes and disagreements and lead to the degradation of the tribal-state relationship. But Chief Clarissa Sabatis of the Holton Band of Maliseets says the task force recommendations should be the beginning of a new era, not only for the tribes, but for the state.
It has taken us 40 years to reach this moment, and I hope that you are all able to stand in our shoes and understand the positive impacts that your decisions can set in motion.
Sabatis says she understands the fear of the unknown, but she reminded the committee that there are more than 560 other tribal nations across the country that live with the same rights as those that are being proposed in this bill. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Have a great weekend. I'm Jennifer Mitchell.